Go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's March 22nd, 2007, 9 a.m. Actually, 2 minutes. 2 minutes after. 2 minutes after. With us today, Senator Hoffman, Senator Huggins, Senator Elton, Senator Dyson. We're going to have one bill on the agenda today, Senate Bill 123, which makes technical clarifications and revisions for our retirement system, both defined benefit and defined contribution, which means all of our tiers concerning our schools, municipalities, university, along with the state. We're going to have some public testimony. We'll answer questions, and we'll just kind of play it by ear as we work through this bill. There won't be most likely a meeting tomorrow. We'll be reconvening at 9 a.m. on Monday to do further work on 123, the bill in front of us today, 125, which is the cost share bill and retirement system, and we're going to be doing some little bit of bill work next week. I have yet to make that schedule, just in case people happen to not watch this meeting until the end. They'll have an idea what's coming, just in case this one's a little dry today. With that, Ms. Melanie Milhorn, the Director of Retirement and Benefits, is here to help us answer questions, along with Kathy Lee, the Retirement Manager of the Division of Retirements and Benefits, and Charlene Morrison, the CFO. So we've got a full implementation of technical people to answer all the hard questions. And do we have any call-ins yet? Anybody on the list? Do we have any Ms. Milhorn and Ms. Lee or Ms. Morrison could come forward in the hot chair and for questions. Do we have any questions from the sitting members this morning? There's only a couple other people in the audience. Is there going to be questions from the audience today? Only two or three people, so it's pretty quiet in here. Maybe we can take a quick look at Section 12. And it's on page 3 of 29 of the sectional analysis. But in that modification, maybe you could explain what that is and why the, if I'm reading that correctly, that why the member would not be able to take the surplus assets. Is that, or am I misinterpreting that?
For the record, my name is Charlene Morrison, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Section 12 deals with termination of the plan as a whole. So if the administrator were to terminate the plan entirely, this section indicates that if at that time there were assets in excess of the actuarially calculated liabilities, that those excess assets would revert back to the employers. And that is a provision that our tax consultants recommended we put into the statutes, because our statutes are in fact the plan provision, the plan document, and this sort of provision is something that's required by the Internal Revenue Code.
Okay. So when we go forward, and just for the sake of conversation, assume we adopt the cost share concept, which I think is highly likely that we're going to do that once we work out the details for PERS. Is there things in the technical bill in front of us that would have to be modified then to fit into the cost share concept?
Yes, there are. If both these bills were to pass, there are some reconciliations that would need to take place.
Okay. that leads to the question of bill timing. I think there's a reasonable chance that both these bills will move through the system. And if they do, would you recommend that the cost share bill move first, and then we have some amendments to this bill? Or do you feel, from your perspective, that we should move the cost share bill along with the technical cleanup and then have a third bill to reconcile?
We've talked about this a little bit, and I think from the division standpoint, we've assumed that the technical bill would move first, and then we could make whatever changes we needed to make in the cost share bill to align the various sections that need the reconciliation. I think maybe Melanie can correct me if I'm wrong, but I would think that it wouldn't really matter which one, but as soon as one passes, it's the remaining bill that we would do the reconciliation process in.
Okay. Senator Elton.
On Section 12, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And I realize this is existing language and is not being changed, but on Section 12, page 7, line 23, the sentence, the amount of benefits is not subject to employer discretion. I'm wondering if that speaks directly to the issue of correctional officers who want to negotiate their benefits.
For the record, my name is Melanie Milhorn, and I'm the director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And through the chair, Senator Elton, that language does not speak to the issue of negotiation with collective bargaining units.
So if I could follow up, Mr. Chair. So I mean, what is this language designed to do? I mean, it seems to me that if it says the amount of benefits is not subject to employer discretion, that seems to me to directly say that an employer in negotiating with employees doesn't have the discretion to talk about benefits. Am I just missing something here?
And through the chair, Senator Elton, what I believe this is saying is that it's not subject to the employer's discretion. In statute right now, what the there's a provision that specifically says that it's for the exclusive benefit of the members. And okay. Then when you go beyond that point, what Charlene had explained is that if you terminate the plan as a whole, you must satisfy the financial obligations to the members first, and after that point, if there is any excess assets, then those would revert to the employer.
Okay,
great. We recently received a decision regarding negotiations for collective bargaining units from the Alaska Labor Relations Agency in the last couple of weeks, where that issue went forward. There was an argument that retirement benefits should be negotiable. And the Alaska Labor Relations Agency said no, they are not negotiable.
Okay. Thanks, Melanie. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Just on a kind of along those similar lines, when we're talking about a shutdown either of the plan in the entirety or may even be applicable to somebody opting out and before we do the cost share. My understanding is that when you close the plan down, that the IRS uses substantially lower targeted rates of return into the, actually my understanding is they use bond market returns, which would be substantially less than the 8.25 target, which then would have a tendency of pushing up the required present value of the assets needed. So you would have a huge, most likely a huge or a substantial increase in the assets required to facilitate shutting down the plan to ensure that the employees get their benefits. Is that remotely close to your understanding or?
Mr. Chair, I have not had a discussion with our tax counsel on exactly what happens if the plan itself were terminated. So I can't answer that question.
I think that's how the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation works when you shut down plans in the private sector. So I'm assuming that they'll have similar rationale into this sector too, to ensure that the employees get the benefits due them, that the assets are actually there in 20 years, regardless if the employer's there or not.
I would agree.
What's the administration's rationale for including the new authority to intercept funds? That was came up the other day. It seems to be kind of a, I wouldn't say a new concept, but something that's being clarified. And could you please go over that?
The division right now has no legal authority to intercept and receive state funds for an employer who is asked to on their contributions. So in discussions with the Department of Law, it was recommended that something be done in statutes to give us that authority. From the division standpoint, we're just looking to make sure that we protect the plan as a whole to the extent that we possibly can. If employers do not pay their contributions, someone else has to pay those contributions. Whether and in a cost share plan, it would be the other employers. And from the division's perspective, we're just looking for a way to protect others in the plan.
When you're referring to intercepting of funds, you're referring to intercepting state assistance to the particular communities?
Yes, that is true.
And not other monies that may be coming in, federal monies or other monies? Or
no, it specifically states, I would have to look that up, but no, we have not discussed federal monies or anything at that point. At the division level, we've discussed state funding that is not appropriated for a specific purpose. And there is a provision, or there was a provision in, there still is a provision in the TERS statutes that allows the division to go to the Department of Education and collect past due TERS contributions. So we started there to try to craft what this language might look like in the PERS.
And Mr. Chairman, I would just add that whenever a situation like that were to happen in the future, without this provision, what would happen? What would be the recourse by the administrator if you had an employer who owed the system $3 million but was not going to pay that obligation to the system? And it triggers, it initiates a cause of action. So we would have to go to Department of Law, and we would have to begin a legal process whereby we would try to secure those funds to make the system whole. And by having an intercept provision instead, then you don't have to go through. If there are other sources of funds that the state could intercept, it would not generate a cause of action where you would end up in litigation with the employer, and that's costly.
Senator Elton, you had a question?
Thanks. I'm trying to wrap my head around the concept, and this did come up the other day, as the chair noted. But the language in Section 1 on page 2, beginning on lines 10, it talks about, as you phrased it, the intercept. And I just, I'm going to give a couple of examples and see if I understand what you're talking about. When you talk about that are not restricted by statute or appropriation to a specific purpose, I would imagine that then means that you couldn't intercept foundation formula dollars because those are dollars designed for a special purpose. Is that correct?
And through the chair, Senator Elton, yes, I believe that you would not be able to intercept those funds because they are dedicated for a specific purpose.
Okay, and that would also then apply to bond proceeds because bonds are issued for a specific purpose. But it wouldn't apply to the muni share of the raw fish tax.
And through the chair, Senator Elton, I would agree.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Chair.
Can we have a little clarification on the elected officials issue in here, and that we're not creating a new benefit? There might have been a drafting omission in 141. I know we had talked quite a bit about the elected officials, and some communities opt in their assembly or council members. Some of them maybe their planning commission. Some of them their commissioners on our hospital. And it was always a local decision whether to opt in to the PERS system for elected officials or not. So could you please clarify the clarification?
The bill, for the record, my name is Kathy Lee, and I'm the retirement manager for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. The bill adds only elected state officials, the lieutenant governor, the governor, and members of the legislature. It does not add municipal elected officials because of the concerns that have been expressed about the cost of providing those benefits to elected officials.
Let me.
In what section was that, Mr. Chairman? Yeah. What section were you referring to?
I didn't write the section down on the question, but we'll dig that. We'll take an Addies and dig it out. We're back on the record. I think it's page
52.
And the chairman kind of scrambled that question, so we'll go ahead and clarify that section.
Okay, the section 110 defines a member or employee as a person who is eligible to participate in the plan and includes the governor, the lieutenant governor, and a member of the legislature. It also clarifies that it includes the Department of Education and Early Development positions that it excludes the positions for the Department of Education and Early Development that require a teaching certificate. Those folks participate in the teacher's retirement system. It does not include municipal elected officials. It only includes state elected officials. State elected officials receive a salary rather than a stipend, and so the contributions that they pay are more in line with an employee rather than the municipal elected official who may receive only $50 a meeting.
Senator Hoffman.
And then this would apply to only the elected officials at the municipal level that will be elected, but the people that are already in the system, they will be covered and have tenure.
Any, through the chair, Senator Hoffman, any elected municipal official that is working for or participating in PERS with their employer that has been elected prior to July 1st, 2006 will remain in the defined benefit plan unless they elect to waive their rights there. Anyone elected after July 1st, 2006 does not, on the municipal level, does not participate in the DCR plan.
What if they're elected and then they come up for re-election? Would they not be eligible, or would they still continue under the defined benefits plan?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, we look at when a person first enters the PERS as setting their tier of benefits. So if they were elected, first elected prior to July 1st, 2006, they would remain in the defined benefit plan upon re-election.
And even if they would, say, get out of public service for 10 years and then come back in, they would still be eligible because they were covered prior?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, that's correct. As long as they didn't refund their employee contributions after their term of office, they could return at a later date to another PERS covered position and remain in the DB plan.
And one follow-up question. Does this also apply to individuals that that are on school boards?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, yes, it does. School board members are considered elected officials and they participate under PERS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Elmer.
While we're on page 52, Mr. Chair, the next section, section 111, defines peace officer or firefighter, but excludes from the definition of peace officer or firefighter a village public safety officer. And what's the rationale for that exclusion?
Yeah. And through the chair, Senator Elton, there was a private letter ruling that the Division of Retirement and Benefits received back in 2004, and that private letter ruling from the IRS prohibited participation by village public safety officers in the defined benefit plan.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, I feel compelled to go back a step and perhaps correct the record. Back to Section 1, when I had asked whether or not foundation formula funds were funds dedicated to a specific purpose, I was working off language on line 12 on page 2, and I didn't notice that up above, beginning on line 4, and it does say that the Department of Education Early Development from state funds do the school district, that is allowed to go after, that you are allowed to intercept foundation formula funds, is the way I read this.
And through the chair, Senator Elton, we just had a sidebar here recently after I had made that statement, and I stand corrected.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
In the event that the state was to pursue that and cut off funding to schools, I don't think it would go very well in the legislature. We will not put our children in that position.
Mr. Chair, I absolutely agree. So maybe this is a superfluous a part of the bill. Mm-hmm.
But we are not going to move the bill today. We'll bring it back. So when we flush some of this stuff out, if there's anything we work, we still have an opportunity to do it. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure whether it's in this bill or the other that has the 2010 provision. Is it this bill that has the two?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, there's two provisions in this bill that deal with the date of July 1, 2010. And what that bill in Senate Bill 2-123 does is for those conditional service benefits under PERS and TERS,
right,
is that they must come back and reinstate that by July 1 of 2010, or they forfeit that conditional service benefit under PERS or TERS. And also there's a public service benefit under PERS in which they must come back and reestablish that indebtedness in order to receive that benefit. So it's actually under PERS, under TERS, and a third one under PERS that's the public.
Okay, so where's that in the bill? because I think that has a little bit, if I recall correctly, what Senator Hoffman was, his questions were, there are some implications about 2010.
I have section 17 in TERS, which is Alaska Statute 1425.310. And section 60 in PERS. And what this does is it aligns with the earlier repeal of the indebtedness provisions under PERS and TERS in Senate Bill 141. And in this particular case, the conditional service benefit, what that allows a member to do who is eligible to receive that benefit in one retirement system, say for example PERS, but they've refunded out of TERS, is that benefit is very expensive because conditional service benefits allow members to receive a medical plan under both retirement systems. So this does two things. One, it aligns with Senate Bill 141 and the repeal of the indebtedness provisions. And then it also is a very expensive benefit to the system. And so it's being addressed to align with Senate Bill 141 and recognize that that's an expensive benefit. There's approximately 2,000 members who have a conditional service benefit right now, meaning that they receive a benefit from PERS and TERS, have a medical plan for PERS and TERS.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that point, is there any provisions in the legislation that require the state to give notification?
And through the chair, Senator Hoffman, when Senate Bill 141 was passed, we did send out notification to all the members who had refunded out. So we did that, and we would expect to do the very same thing in this particular instance when this bill passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Maybe we can go on and get a little bit of clarification. What happens when a defined benefit member who moves from the DB employer to the DC employer, the defined contribution employer, which is the new plan, where that puts that employee, is he or she going to be in the continuing the defined benefit or the defined or the new defined contribution? Again, this is an employee going from one employer to another employer.
And Senator Stedman, the way that would work, if there's a newly established employer, then they would come in and then their members would be under the defined contribution plan. If a member is a DB member and becomes an employee of that new employer, then they actually will end up with two benefits. One, they will have their DB benefit, which is, that's not removed from the employee, and then they will go on to earn service as a new defined contribution retirement member. So they will have two benefits under two retirement systems. Say that they leave that employer and go back to a PERS participating employer that's not a new employer, then they would continue to earn additional service under the DB plan.
Okay. Senator Elman.
Melanie, is that only for vested members, vested DB members, or what if it's a DB member that has 3 years in?
And through the chair, Senator Elton, it wouldn't make any difference if they just had 3 years or if they were vested. The same scenario would apply. So for example, an individual has 3 years of service, they go to a new employer, and all of those members are under the defined contribution retirement plan. They would go on to earn service under that new tier four. They've got 3 years of service. They leave that new employer and they go back to another participating employer. They go on to earn additional service investing in that DB plan.
Okay, yep. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr.
Can a deferred defined benefit member establish their account prior to 2010 without being rehired by an enrolled employer? It's kind of a deer in the headlight question, I guess.
Senator Hoffman, a deferred member by statute is, or excuse me, Senator Stedman, a deferred member by statute is defined as a member who still has contributions in the system. Mm. So in that case, there, if they had any portion of their service that they had refunded, they would need to reinstate that amount before July 1st, 2010. But because they're a deferred member, that means that they have some contributions in the plan, so they would remain a DB member, but they would forfeit the portion of service that they had refunded out. So for example, if they had had two periods of employment, say one in the 70s and they refunded, and then came back in the 80s, and they worked for 3 or 4 years, then terminated but did not refund. As of July 1st, 2010, if they have not reinstated that 70s service, they forfeit it totally, but they still remain a DB member, because a deferred member has contributions remaining in the plan and is still considered a member.
So the benefit reduction there to the employee in this example, assuming that the 70, well, that's obviously tier one, the other one possibly after 85 would be tier two. They, under this example, the employee then would give up their health benefit, which is the key there on their age, their early retirement from age 50 to age 60. That would be the delta that of the benefit that would be on the table to be given up. Is that correct?
Senator Stedman, that's correct. We would look at the forfeited service as totally forfeited after July 1st, 2010. And if their second period of service crossed a tier, they would be in that new tier based on their paid up service.
Okay. And then is the administration then in their notification to employees going to make that clear to the employees, these incremental changes we're looking at in the bill here? Or what kind of notifications are we looking at to the employee base? What's required and what's not?
Senator Stedman, when SB 141 passed, we did advise all employees that if they did not reinstate their service by July 1st, 2010, anyone that had refunded service, that they would forfeit that service and forfeit their tier, or possibly forfeit their tier.
Just a second. Go ahead.
Excuse me, we just had a little sidebar.
Oh, I know. That was waiting. Then we're going to go to Senator Huggins, and you're done with your answer.
One of the things that the division did was they purchased a system called Accurant that allowed us to go back and make an effort to find current addresses for all these folks. So we didn't just take old addresses in our system and send out notices. We did make an effort to find the current address for every affected employee.
Yeah, I had three or four people, you know, personal friends and acquaintances after that notification went out asked me about it. It was so people were receiving and reading their mail, which is a good sign on this. Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm familiar with 403B. I realize there's a 403A if there's a B, but what is a 403A account?
Through the chair, I believe, Senator Huggins, that they are annuity-type accounts. The Division of Retirement and Benefits does not administer a 403A or a 403B, but that's what I believe they are. I can't be certain, though.
Okay, because 403B, as I recall, is for, I think, some medical professions, and teachers are eligible, and maybe some others. That's the two that I'm familiar with. But leads me to a larger question. As I recall, part of our objective trying to meet is get as much alignment as possible between PERS and TERS in between these two bills. Is that accurate? No?
Not for this particular bill. This is the technical clarification bill. With the cost share bill, we're looking for alignment in how
right,
the plans.
Right, between the two. Between the two. I mean, that's the byproduct is an alignment factor. It's one of our objectives. Is that to the extent it's in the other bill, it would be helpful to me, and I think maybe some of the rest of us, of where there are modifications that are made to make PERS look more like TERS or TERS like PERS, where those are, so we can see what the what alignment we accomplish, what we don't accomplish, but so we see the contrast in the two, where there is contrast and where there is alignment and how we created the alignment. I think it would be beneficial for me at least to see what changes we're actually making that works for the system overall.
And through the chair, Senator Huggins, maybe I could clarify for just a moment. I think you're exactly right in that those provisions in PERS and TERS, if you take this bill and look at it in totality, what you will find is many of those provisions that are being changed in PERS replicate in TERS. That's why this bill is so lengthy.
Right.
And if you strip out those changes that replicate one another, then you get down to about 5 pages of changes that are the Pension Protection Act. So this bill is large in volume because you can turn to one provision in TERS and then another section in PERS, and that very same provision is going to apply with regard to some of those provisions that our legal tax advisor, Ice Miller, has said you need to have this in your plan to continue you to maintain your plan qualified status. So maybe
yeah.
if that.
Yeah.
Could you define plan qualified status? People at home know what that is.
Senator Stedman, what we have here is a plan that is governed by the Internal Revenue Code in order to provide benefits to members on a tax-preferred basis. And so we have to maintain a qualified plan in order to have those benefits be provided to members on a tax-preferred basis. And that's very beneficial to the members, and it's beneficial to the plan as well. And under the Pension Protection Act in 2006, they have additional requirements that are going to come into play for governmental plans to ensure that they maintain that qualified status. And so many of those provisions are applicable in this particular case so that we are in good standing to go forward and maintain that qualified plan status in 2008. So every 5 years now, plans are going to have to renew that with the Internal Revenue Code. That is something that didn't happen in the past. The plans under PERS and TERS first became qualified in 2001 for PERS and TERS.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Melanie, to that extent, under the new requirements, our underfunding, are there some provision that are going to really impact us that we have some milestones we have to meet based on that may be difficult or maybe not difficult, but milestones that is important for us to know about and be considering? In other words, percent of funding or, I mean, whatever the ramifications are, I'm not familiar with what the changes happen to be, but I know they're brought about because of underfunded plans and plans that collapsed and had to be picked up by the federal guarantee.
And through the chair, Senator Huggins, the Pension Protection Act does require under the ERISA plans a different kind of funding structure, and they have to come up to a certain percentage is my understanding, but it's also my understanding that that is not applicable to our government plans, so we're not under the same guidelines. I would ask Charlene if she disagrees with that. I've not extensively studied the Pension Protection Act, but that is my understanding.
That is my understanding as well. Government plans do not fall under ERISA. But what you're speaking of sounds like ERISA qualifications.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So there isn't anything like that I am aware of that needs to be rolled into our plans.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Elton, I think you had another question.
I did. Thanks, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, I want to say this isn't a test of the professionals at the other end of the table. It's just an indication that I sometimes think of a question 5 or 10 minutes too late. I want to go back to Section 110 and the discussion that we had about elected officials, elected municipal officials, and ask if this excludes, as a member, an elected mayor that receives a salary. And I'm thinking specifically of my community of Juneau, for example, where there is a salary. I think Anchorage has a mayor that receives a salary, and I'm sure other communities do. How are they treated with this language?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, we have an informal opinion that an elected full-time mayor would be treated as an employee as they meet the requirements under the IRS as an employee. There's 11 different requirements that designate what makes an employee versus a contractor, and since they do meet those requirements, that they would be classified as an employee and could be covered under the plan.
So if I could follow up, so my community pays a salary to the mayor, but the mayor could be an employee of a private firm, or it could be an employee of, well, it could be employed elsewhere. So they would be precluded from being a member if they had a full-time job working for Sea Alaska, for example.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, that's correct. To be considered an employee, they would have to be a full-time mayor, and that needs to be their full-time job.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
I think in the retirement structure that we have now, we've tightened up the hours that the assembly or a council member would have to put in annually to qualify also, if I remember correctly. It's been tightened up somewhat, but it's still a local option if the community wants their assembly and council and elected officials that are quasi-volunteer, you know, from sitting on assemblies. I know I hate to use the word volunteer because there's quite a workload on the councils and the assemblies, but that's been tightened up because there was, in some communities around the state, there appeared to be some abuse of the system where it went out and touched on a lot of other committees other than councils or the assembly.
It just seems odd that mayors who are supervisors of public employees that would qualify to be a member in their supervisory capacity would not be allowed to become a member.
Well, we could get some clarification on some of that for you before we come back. Do we have any other questions? We wrap this up today. You have another one?
I do. Thanks, Mr. Chair. And it goes to sections 21 through, I think, probably 31, beginning on page 12 of the bill. Do these sections in any way constitute a diminishment of benefits to defined contribution employees who are hired after July 1st of 2006 but before the effective date of this bill?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, if I could answer that question kind of section by section.
Sure.
I think that would help. Section 21 updates the rollover provisions. And that is actually an expansion of the available rollover options that employees had on July 1st, 2006. Prior to this, it was only a conduit IRA that you could roll in or roll out to. Now you can roll in or out to any of the IRAs that are described in Title 26 of the United States Code, and also adds a Roth IRA. So that's an expansion of benefits. Section 22 is a requirement that is existing or any plan that accepts pre-tax and post-tax dollars that they do have to account for it separately. This is a codification that has to be in as a requirement of the Pension Protection Act. Section 23 specifies that contributions to the plan will be deposited into the appropriate plans or trusts and sets a payment deadline for contributions for the end of the school year. Again, this is more of a codification of existing practice and needs to be in our statutes to conform to the Internal Revenue Code for our upcoming qualification in 2008, so that is not a diminishment of any benefits. Section 24 provides for interest to be charged on contributions that are not transmitted to the TERS from employers timely, and this is under the DCR plan. This actually is an enhancement as well, because prior to this we had no authority to charge any interest on late DCR payments. Section 25 clarifies that defined contributions paid to a member's individual account are subject to the limitations on 415 under 415C of the Internal Revenue Code. Again, this is not a diminishment because we have been administering the contributions that are coming into the plan, particularly those in the form of conversion from the DB to the DC plan and employer matches in this way, and we are required to observe those limits. Section 26 clarifies the termination of a disability benefit when a person no longer meets requirements to receive occupational disability or recovers from the disability. This is simply a clarification of the process that we would go through, and again, it is not a diminishment. And how much farther?
Well, I appreciate the sections 21 through 25, but 26 through 31, and you've addressed 26, and you said that's a clarification of an existing practice, and I guess the question is that a diminishment of benefit? I mean, clarification of a practice is not the same as clarification of law. I mean, the practice has to comport with existing law. And so my concern is that in some of these sections, 26 through 31, that what we might be doing is we might be clarifying a practice but changing law that amounts to a diminishment of a benefit for that class of employees that have been recently hired, after the middle of last year and before the effective date of this bill.
Maybe we can go through those. You can walk us through those section by section.
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Elton, one thing I did want to also clarify is, as part of the emergency regulations that the division promulgated last year, these are codifications of those regulations in statute. It is our preference to have these in statute rather than just in regulations.
Again, and we don't need to answer this question at the table today because it is kind of a complicated question, but of course regulations have to have statutory authority, and that's kind of the question that I'm trying to get to. And I don't mean to put you on the spot today, and if you want to think about it, that's fine, and you can get back in touch with the committee. It's up to you. You can do it today or later.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, we can clarify that for you.
Thanks.
Did you still want me to go through Section 31?
Yes, we're fairly close to that, if you could, and then we'll wrap up unless we have further questions.
Okay, Section 27 provides that a member who receives disability benefits from the plan is 100% vested in all the employer contributions made to the member's individual account. This is a requirement of the Internal Revenue Service. The benefits that the party has needs to be non-forfeitable, and in order to provide those, they must be 100% vested in those contributions, since the employer is still making employer and employee contributions to that account while they're on disability. So this is actually, the way the bill reads, they would not have been, the way SB 141 read, they would not have, it could have been construed that they would not have been 100% vested in those contributions. Section 28 clarifies the termination of disability benefits when a disabled member first qualifies for normal retirement. This is simply a clarification. Those items are throughout SB 141, but there was no one place that we could point to that said for very clearly this is when it ends. And so we wanted that clarification to be in there so it's clear.
There was considerable discussion on that issue dealing with that bill, the transition from disability to retirement and making sure that there's not a double dip at the end.
Section 29 are related to benefits for the survivor of a disabled member. It clarifies four things. When the termination of the survivor's pension occurs, when it clarifies that the survivor cannot access the member's individual account while receiving a survivor benefit. It also clarifies the normal retirement benefits that are available to the survivor and clarifies that the period of disability benefits and the period of survivor benefits constitute service for eligibility for medical benefits and the HRA. These items all were in the intent and in the discussion under SB 141. And again, this is to clarify those rights to the employee. Section 30 clarifies the definition of occupational disability. I believe in SB 141, it referred to the definition that is contained in the defined benefit plans. This allows the DCR plan to have its own definition that is clear in its own statutes of what constitutes an occupational disability. It is the same definition that occurs in the defined benefit plan. And the last section, section 31, requires employers to fund the additional benefit for survivors for a disabled member by making contributions to the appropriate trust accounts based on the deceased member's gross monthly compensation. The legislature in crafting SB 141 provided for a benefit for the survivor at the point the member would have reached normal retirement, that they would have the contributions in that account that the member would have paid had they lived, along with the employer contributions and the investment income. However, the Internal Revenue Code does not allow for this. It does not allow for payment of any contributions into a deceased member's account past December 31st of the year in which they die. So what this section does is it provides a tax-qualified method to provide the benefits that the legislature intended.
Thank you. So, Senator Elton, do you want further clarification of these items before the next meeting? Do you want to get with our staff?
It would be helpful, sure. Mr. Chair. I mean, I understand the clarification part. I think it's probably a fine line on what is a clarification and what is a change, and I think we probably need to understand that.
Sure. We're going to hold on to this bill for a few more days. We'll work on those clarifications, and if any other member has questions, if you could please get that to my staff, we'll work on answers to those, and then we'll see you, all the committee members, bright and early Monday morning at 9 o'clock for the cost share bill. Thank you very much. Meeting adjourned.